Welcome to episode 284 of Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as ever, John Lindemann.
Pleased to be here, Johnny.
Greg Leahy.
We ever mentioned on this show how much I love Mario.
And, of course, James actually is not with us this week, or at least not for this part of the show. He might show up later, we're not sure. And in his place, we have our esteemed colleague, Mr. William Berghammer.
Wow, William? Really?
I said esteemed, so I just had to pair it.
It's only when I'm in trouble or...
Oh, sorry. You're definitely not in trouble. No, Billy's here, and in fact, Billy, I gotta say, I'm not a fan of your nickname on Weekend Confirmed. Plan B, I think, plays down how great you are on that show. So I'm gonna give you a new nickname, and I want you to carry this back to Garnet.
Okay.
BB Action.
BB Action.
Did you guys ever play BB Action in middle school? It's like a punching game.
I will have to use the Googles on that.
So we have an exciting show for you today. We got some really interesting games to talk about in new business. And then in the second segment, we're going to branch out a little bit, talk about some kind of miscellaneous topics. We're going to talk about what Billy's been doing of late. And we're also going to at least broach the topic of the shakeup that's been happening in the games media. So without further ado, Billy, as our guest, I would love for you to go first, especially since you played a 3DS game that none of us have played.
I'm assuming you're talking about Mario Tennis. So Nintendo did not really have too big of a presence at GDC. You know, they trotted out their usual small booth size that they do for GDC and had a bunch of 3DS demos. They had Kid Icarus, but they did not have any Frankensticks on hand, which I think sucks because that was what I was like waiting to try.
And you're left-handed, right?
I am left-handed. So Metroid on DS, I just could never play. Like, it just would get away from me. Like, targeting and everything sucks. You know, when you're left-handed and trying to use a stylus to the right hand, it just, the shit does not work right.
But the DS was symmetrical in a way that the 3DS isn't. There's a bigger problem.
Yeah, well, and agreed. And so, you know, I'm excited about getting, I'm supposed to swing by now that I live in Seattle or surrounding areas and live close to NOA. I've been invited over to the new building and to see the new store and to plunk down my credit card and probably spend a lot of money on shit that I don't really need, but I will be getting a Frankenstick and actually Rhythm Heaven. That's another game that actually Best Buy didn't have. I don't know if stores are stocking it.
I bought the last copy at Target this week. I haven't even opened it yet. Well, I opened it and registered in Club Nintendo, but I haven't actually played it yet.
Yeah, I haven't looked too hard for it, but when I was just at Best Buy recently, I was like, oh, I should pick that up, and I'm psyched to play that. But yeah, Mario Tennis was in the booth. They had Resident Evil, and they had other stuff that was already out. And, you know, as I said, their presence wasn't very big. Wii U was nowhere to be seen. So outside of street passing like crazy throughout the show, you know, I played Mario Tennis, which I actually really liked. But my concern is this game is going to be a full-price 3DS game, and I just think that's a lot of money for something as simple as tennis. But I know the game is fully featured, and there's multiplayer. And
do you think it's a problem that you can run through a match of tennis a lot faster than you can go through a round of golf?
Maybe. I mean, I'm sure there's going to be some sort of tournament structure and taking your character and playing all the other characters and all that sort of structure.
Yeah, there is no RPG element this time, correct?
Well, that we've seen, and it would seem unlikely they sort of spring it on us late, but then the whole thing's been quite suddenly developing. The only thing I've seen that's a bit different from previous iterations, there's some sort of issue of upgrading your racket or something. You can like get different rackets, and I don't know what that entails, how deep that goes.
You can put diamonds on it.
Well, I don't really know anything about that. I'm pretty sure that there is no RPG elements, but I could be wrong. Camelot is still at the helm of it, so that is a good sign. That makes me happy. They did seem to strip away the obnoxious power shots that were in, I think, was that the Wii version that
There was no Wii version. The Wii version was a port of the GameCube version.
Okay. Yeah, and those, I thought, totally broke the game, and I was a big Mario Tennis guy on the 64. Like, I loved that game.
Oh, yeah.
It was the first game I ever imported, and and played the hell out of it. I remember at E3, the first E3 I ever went to, it was just a big hit, no pun intended. But on 3DS, it's pretty good. I enjoyed it. There seems to be a lot of curved shots. So they do these crazy boomerang moves where you hit a ball and it will travel really far left to right or right to left, which gets a little tricky at times, even though you do see some sort of a, you know, marking on screen of where the ball will land. It does definitely throw things off a lot. You know, I didn't sit there and play it for a long time. I picked it up because I just wanted to try it, because someone from NOA was watching me play it and wanted my feedback on it. And it wasn't just some booth babe. It was actually somebody from Team Nintendo. And she asked me if I was familiar with the franchise and all that sort of stuff. And like, she's like, yeah, it's Camelot. And I'm like, okay, well, you actually know something. So, you know, I'm like, did you pull out the power shots? And she's like, yep. I'm like, okay, then we're already on the right page. Cause that totally broke the GameCube version, I thought. So I think they did mention it does have online multiplayer, which is cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
It does. Yeah.
It was promising.
It's one of those things, like, if you're playing it online, will you actually be able to tell the difference versus playing against the computer?
Well, it depends about lag, you know?
Is there that much style to how you play tennis?
Well, I don't know. You know, that's the thing that sucks. I mean, that's something, you know, if I was playing against you, I would want to be talking a lot of shit while I was playing. I mean, that's,
yeah.
You know, that was a lot of reasons why the 64 version was so much fun playing on the couch with friends. It's like, especially when you're playing doubles, it's a lot of people talking shit and screaming at each other. You know, that's probably something that I'll look forward to experiencing at E3. I don't know when it comes out, but
I think it's May.
May, yeah.
You know, experiencing at E3 with you guys, you know, sitting around drinking beer, I mean, that's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, when was the last time we sat down and drank a beer at E3, Billy? It's been a few years.
I think 2 years.
I was lucky to street pass you last year.
Well, you know, E3 conventions are tough. You know,
yeah,
it was like, yeah, let's catch up at E3. It's like, yeah, good luck.
It's kind of in a sense, it's the worst possible time to try to meet up with someone and actually hang out. It's great if you want to meet up in line for a press conference or something, like, you might actually be able to pull that off. But if to actually go and do anything truly social at E3 is just a nightmare to plan.
Yeah, it's really hard, even if you live there. But that being said, you know, outside of that, I think Mario Tennis does use the touch screen to do different shots, but why do that when you have buttons? And the other thing that I thought was kind of neat, it does use the gyro controls, so you can lift, you know, you can raise the 3DS and get more of like a over-the-shoulder RE4 sort of viewpoint of, you know, the court.
In real time?
In real time.
Weird.
And you can also, I think, she said you can also, like, with the gyroscope, when you're in that view, you can look at a certain point. So say you want to cross court and do the right corner, you can aim that way and then hit your shot that way. But as far as gyroscopic controls, like, it's just really not for me too much, unless it's...
It's hard when it's connected to the screen.
Well, yeah, and it's something that's so quick, and especially if you're using 3D, then, you know, then it throws that shit off. You know, the only time I really liked the gyroscopic controls was in Zelda, where you could refine your aim when you're using the bows and slingshot. Like, I really like that. Like, that actually works really well. But, you know, I haven't tried it in tennis. You know, I'm, I guess, more traditional Mario Tennis player, so, you know, I liked it just the regular way it was, but... Do I think I'll pick it up? I don't know. I mean, it depends. If it's only $30, maybe, you know, I'm pretty crowded right now when it comes to the handheld space. I have a brand new Vita, you know, and I've been playing the hell out of that and really like that super large screen. It's really hard. Not that I want to be a snob, but it's hard to go back to the 3DS after you have this giant OLED screen and almost PlayStation 3 quality graphics, you know. But, you know, I do love the Mario Tennis, so I'll probably get sucked in.
Did you see Waluigi?
I played as Waluigi.
Fuck yes.
But outside of that, I did, you know, I don't get to Street Pass a lot because actually now that I live in Bellevue, which is, there's a lot of Nintendo employees that live in this city, occasionally I'll pick up my 3DS and be like, oh, wow, somebody in my neighborhood actually has one and Street Pass, and that's cool. But places like GDC or PAX or E3 are the best places to really get deep into, like, Find Me or start getting picture pieces. And Find Me 2, I think, is... I don't know if I like it as much as the first one, because even though they did make it a lot more advanced, you know, now I'm at this point where I'm in some poison room and I need to do something and I can't figure out what I'm doing to clear the room. So, you know, I get 10 people to go in to battle somebody and they all get turned away because there's poison in the room. I could be doing something completely wrong, but, like, you know, I think that stuff's kind of fun, you know, like the hats and having that on your Mii, and, like, I don't know. I like, it's really cheesy. and it's super simplistic, but that stuff I think is really neat. I don't even, and the Vita has got something kind of like that with Nier. And actually what I do like about Vitas is that it actually unlocks things that, you know, your friend, you know, when you pass by your friends that have certain games, it unlocks things within your game, like soundtracks, songs, or pieces of art, or it's all nothing really necessary, but any connectivity sort of thing I think is cool stuff.
Yeah. Street Pass can do that. Most games don't seem to use it that way, but like Ridge Racer, you actually, if you Street Pass, you can convert your Street Passes into the points in the game that you use to buy cars.
See, that I think is great. And things like Find Me, you know, it encourages people, especially at nerd conventions, to bring theirs with them.
And in the case of Ridge Racer, it's actually great motivation to actually turn the game back on if you haven't played it in a while, because you're being kind of rewarded for coming back to it. I think it's a good strategy, but most games don't seem to be really using it for that. And I think we've barely scratched the surface of what it can really be used for. And I still think there's going to be some kind of crazy, I don't know if it'll be like an eShop game, something that's fairly cheap, but has some kind of mass appeal, you know, that a lot of people really want to get in on it, and it will be primarily driven by Street Pass. It'll be some kind of interaction that you couldn't get with anything else, and that will be the core of the gameplay. It'll be kind of like the Find Me RPG, but something a little bit different.
I'd love to see more of it. When you see where these people are from, especially at conventions and stuff, I find it fascinating, especially now that they have these not achievements attached to them, where, you know, depending on if you got a new territory, you get something not achievement. I think that stuff's cool. Like, I mean, it's minimal, you know, and it's not that big of a deal. And yeah, my friends make fun of me when I'm street passing and stuff, but like,
they're just jealous.
Well, no, I'll bust
haters,
them later.
Haters gonna hate.
You know, I'll bust them later when they're like, you know, they'll tweet and say, shit, I totally forgot my 3DS today. I wasted an opportunity to get Street Pass stuff. And it's true because, you know, there's not, in America, there's not, unless, well, I mean, especially if you're an adult and you're not going to grade school or, you know, it just doesn't happen that often. But I enjoy it. I think it's a cool feature. I hope you're right, Johnny. I hope more people, you know, more companies or somebody pulls something off that uses it a lot.
Well, I saw last night there's an entire panel at PAX East that's basically called Street Pass Networking. And it's a panel about Street Pass and how to set up Street Pass events, but it's also just going to be this ridiculous nexus of street passing. And it's right before our RFN panel. So
that's amazing.
If you're going to PAX, go to that and then come and...
Nobody's going to be paying attention. Everybody's going to be head down, pressing A like a motherfucker.
Right, yeah, which takes a lot of pressure off us for our panel, because it doesn't really matter what we say.
I still think it's stupid that you're locked at 10. I think that is a big wasted opportunity.
And that's just for the Street Pass Plaza. I mean, I think for Ridge Racer, the maximum is like 8 or something. And for Mario, it's 3. So,
it's stupid.
Yeah, it must be something technical.
Well, it's a function of file size. Yeah, it's a technical issue. And I don't know if it's something they could address in the OS at some point down the line and dedicate more memory. You know, if they can make some other process more efficient, maybe they can relax some space and free that up for expansion of Street Pass. That would be nice, but at the same time, I mean, it has to work whether or not you have an SD card, right? So it has to exist in the RAM while the system is asleep, and it could be doing a lot of other stuff. It could be cycling your game data in its sleep also, because you've just closed the lid in the middle of the game, and it still has to be able to street pass. Okay, Greg, you're up next for new business.
Yep, I haven't actually had a lot of time to play games this week. I've been, the last few days, I've been doing very little apart from being completely wrapped up in the will they, won't they, Buffalo Bills marry a Williams marriage.
It was consummated.
And with the primaries going on over here, I know you're obsessed with those.
Yeah, that was just Tuesday, the Southern primaries. So yeah, it's been a big week, but not so much in a gaming sense. But I have got to a few things. First of all, I profited off someone's demise. This is the situation of Game, the biggest retailer of games in the UK, that's going through some very harsh financial straits at the minute, and basically their creditors are kind of circling, ready to pull their support if their fortunes don't change, and they're up for sale at the minute. I think GameStop in the US and Walmart have shown interest in possibly buying them at a cut price and
saving them from insolvency. But what this has also meant is that they had what was dubbed a fire sale on all their pre-owned stuff. And this was good for me because basically it seems that when they released Cave Story 3D over here, they did it in such limited quantities that already the only possible way to get it is secondhand. Previous to that, it was still about as much as it is to buy a new game. But with the massive reduction that you had because of them virtually going out of business and a special offer that they were giving because they were closing one of their online operations, which I'd used before, I got it for just a few quid more than it hypothetically will cost on DSiWare if they ever get around to releasing it here. So I was very happy with that. I'm quite taken with the 3D graphics and stuff, but it was difficult to bridge that gap of, you know, 9 quid on DSiWare and 30 quid on at retail.
Oh, yeah.
But games failures have done it for me. So I will probably be getting around to that quite soon. But the only other thing was a surprise demo that came up. They did not announce this at the beginning of the week, as they usually do with all their eShop updates. But it is the demo for Rhythm Thief, the Sega game that's going to be coming out in Europe on April 5th. So we've talked about this a bit before, you know, I'm interested in it, and the demo's just three sort of different kinds of events. There's quite a significant kind of variation in them, although they were all, you know, pretty gentle, as you might expect for the demo. But the first one, it was very Oendan-like. A circle would appear, and then you've got, you know, an outer circle that's sort of gradually moving towards the inner circle, and you're supposed to do an action at the correct time. But unlike Oendan, where you're actually sort of tapping in patterns on the lower screen to match those circles, they'd be on the upper screen, and you just had to do the designated directional swipe on the touch screen at that particular time. So it's pretty easy, but definitely sort of had a lot of that Oendan kind of vibe. Now, the next event was a bit different, because in this case, you kind of, the scenario is called looting the Louvre. And so you're sneaking around all these, you know, antiques and all this stuff. And so what it is four different kinds of statues. And to hide from the guards, the touchscreen being broken into quarters, you've got to click the right quarter at the right time so that he does a pose that matches the statue and is therefore invisible to the patrolling guards. That's pretty fun. You know, they have different timings for each one of the quarters and you get into it. And then the last of the three, you actually now use the D-pad and buttons. And it's like a fight sequence. And so enemies are kind of coming towards you in rhythm, of course. And, you know, you've either got to press A if they're on your right-hand side, or the D-pad if they're on your left-hand side. So it kind of ran the gamut between Oendan on the one hand and Rhythm Heaven on the other. It really felt like a kind of hybrid rhythm game of those, and it seems like, you know, depending on what kind of activity you're going to be doing, it'll be closer to one or the other. I'm not sure how that balance kind of falls out in the main game, but it was all very promising. You know, the vibe of the game, you know, it's got an attractive cel-shaded aesthetic, and the music fits really well with this weird, like, anime Paris out of time in an almost Tim Burton's Batman kind of way.
So does it sound like Danny Elfman? Does it sound like Professor Layton? Does it sound like, I don't know what anime music even sounds like, but...
No, the look is anime, right. Not the sound. That's what's kind of weird about it. You know, it's got a very sort of anime kind of look, but it's set in France, and then the music is more kind of jazzy, you know, heavy on the bass, bit of brass, at least in these sections. So very unique kind of cocktail of elements.
Yeah, that sounds good.
It looks really promising. Obviously, if you've listened to the Famicast on our feed and all that kind of thing, they had it in Japan a bit ago, or if you've read the impressions on the website, lots of good things to be heard about this game. And it's coming up really fast now, isn't it? Actually, this is a couple of weeks after Kid Icarus comes out. So, no, I'm very, very interested in this. I think it's a pretty strong likelihood that I was going to pick it up anyway, but the demo solidified my interest in it.
Yeah, I don't even think it has a release date in North America yet, but I mean, knowing Sega and their past actions, it'll probably up at GameStop one day for $20 and they won't have bothered to tell anyone, including other retailers. I did pick up Crush 3D, by the way. I walked in and I kind of expected the GameStop employee to say, like, did you pre-order it? I would have had a funny response to that, but actually, surprisingly, they did not tell me that. So, yeah, I picked up Crush 3D, have not actually played it yet, because I'm catching up on other games that I bought.
Well, like, a ton of shit, just, like, it was, like, a super quiet first quarter, and then all of a sudden, bam!
Yeah.
It's like...
It's the end of the fiscal year. Yeah, you know, it's that time of year. They got to get it into this to round out their performance of the year so it doesn't look as bad.
I mean, seriously, they could have made February a lot more fun if they would have spread these out a little bit better.
Yeah. Okay, well, John, why don't you tell us what you've been playing this week?
Super Mario 3D Land is what I've been playing, Johnny. Just kind of... I finally actually did beat it. I kind of put in, you know, air quotes kind of thing because, you know, I still feel like there's a whole ton of content that I have to play through. But I did play through the first 8 worlds. Really didn't have too much of a problem with it at all. It's pretty easy, which I suppose is kind of good and bad in my eyes. I mean, I enjoyed it. There was no time. I have yet to hit a wall. I've actually played through to the end of the first special world.
Do you have like 90 lives?
I have like 116. So, I mean, I haven't even dipped. I think actually... Near the end, I died a bunch on the final castle in World 8. And that's when I dipped to about maybe 92. But after, you know, I've built them back up to about 115, 116. But I really, really enjoyed it. I mean, honestly, I figured I would like it, but I'm actually enjoying it much more than I thought I would. Like, I really, really like it.
Yeah, that was my experience as well.
Yeah. You know, like I've said before, it's kind of the perfect blend of sort of the 3D and old school Mario games. I like the fact that it's less puzzle oriented. I always felt like I was making progress. You know, things, it just, you know, goes really quickly.
And one thing I really like about 3D Land is that there are no cutscenes. And
yeah,
I know that sounds like a weird comment about a Mario game, but when I was a few weeks ago when I was going back and trying to finish my 120 stars in Galaxy 2, it, especially doing like the boss rush and some of that other stuff, it made me realize just how many fucking cutscenes there are in the Galaxy games. And a lot of them are 2 seconds long. It's just Mario flying through space, but there's nothing for you to do during that, and it breaks up the pace more than you think. And especially when you fight the bosses, there's way too much. And the thing is, nothing happens in the cutscenes. It's a boss roaring, and he kind of dances around a little bit. And then every time you hit him, there's another cutscene where a petal falls off the giant Petey Piranha. And it's like, come on, just let me fight him.
Yep, so, you know, as I get further into it, it's like, I haven't really seen it ramp up too much in terms of, you know, how hard each area is. They get a little bit more complex, but, you know, you just start to use more stuff out of the toolbox. I mean, the only new stuff I've encountered is just using the rock Tanuki suit, I guess.
It's the real Tanuki suit.
Yeah.
The sad thing is, when I first beat 3D Land and I got the first one of those, I thought, oh, great, so now from now on, all the Tanuki suits are going to be with the red scarf and I can turn into the statue. And no, sometimes you'll still get the old one, and that's really like a sinking feeling in your stomach.
Yeah.
At some point, you'd learn to rely on, especially in the special worlds, some stages, that can make a big difference, especially when there's a moving platform and it's going through a lot of fire jets and stuff like that. Just turn into the statue and ride it out. You know, it's really good for that kind of thing.
And it's, I mean, it's nice to be able to kill some of these, you know, enemies that you absolutely had no way of killing before, like, you know, the spiny shells and whatnot. But yep, so I'm going to keep playing that through that all the way through. So far, I have every single coin I could possibly get in terms of the star coins, so hopefully I can keep doing that. But a couple of things, you know, it's in terms of just the 3DS overall, I've had a couple of weeks to kind of play around with it. Still enjoying Street Pass, still think that's pretty cool, bring that with me. Swap Note, I think that should be called Spam Note because I'm just tired of all the spam I get because I have about 30-ish people on my friends list,
yeah.
One of which should be Billy Berghammer, but he has yet to actually enter my friend code that I tweeted him. So shame on you, Billy. Enter that in.
I'll get on that right now.
When Swap Note first came out, a lot of us were kind of comparing it to Twitter, and over time I started to realize where that comparison breaks down because on Twitter, if you miss a couple days, no one cares. You don't care. Mm-hmm. You're never going to go back and read all the stuff that you missed on Twitter. You're just going to move on. So Twitter always shows you the most recent shit. And if you want to go back an hour and see what people were saying about, you know, if you want to see some of the antecedent comments, you can do that. But generally, you don't really rewind through Twitter a lot, you know?
Yeah.
And the problem with Swapnote is it gets totally backlogged. And, you know, I've got hundreds of notes now, and it would take me hours to go through them all. And most of them are bullshit that I don't care about. But I have no way to filter them from the source. I have no way to filter them by topic. And I have no way to just fast forward to the front and delete all the other ones en masse to open up space for the new ones. I don't care about a swap note that I got 3 weeks ago. Just let me go to the new one, but they only download 20 at a time or whatever. And it's dumb. It's an almost wonderful, perfect feature on the 3DS, but they Nintendo'd it, unfortunately. And it's especially the more friends you have, the more annoying and unbearable swap note becomes.
Yeah. Like they need to add something to just filter content, you know, just, I don't want to see swap notes from this person.
I'm all right playing Mario Kart with you, but I have no interest in what you have to say.
Yep. And you know, that's the thing. You have no way of blocking anybody, filtering anything.
And they're all surprises until they open up.
Yeah. You just don't know. So there's a lot of stuff that they could do to improve it. It's like, great idea, not the best way to execute it.
Yeah. Over time, I've kind of soured on it, and it's become really a chore to open up Swapnote and actually do anything with it. So.
Yeah. And also the fact that even if there is something that you actually want to get, if you try to prune it, it'll say, oh, well, you got a Swapnote, but you got rid of the Swapnote that it was attached to. It's like, you got a reply, but you don't have the swap note that it was attached to, so you don't have it anymore. It's like, well, thanks for forcing me to watch it download and then telling me that I can't read it. So it's just maddening. So, like, classic. You have to have, like, in order to get a reply, you have to still have the actual swap note that was replied to.
All right, so I'll wrap up new business. I've got a couple of eShop games, actually, I want to talk about. I had a few months there where I wasn't downloading anything from the eShop, and actually a couple of really cool games came out earlier this year. So the first one is Mutant Muds. This is from Renegade Kid. The last game of theirs I played was called Moon for DS. It was a first-person shooter, very atmospheric, technically impressive. I thought the design was not great. I didn't feel like the shooting really felt that great, and the world design, although the environments were kind of interesting to look at, they're also really repetitive, and I was getting lost, and to me it was a real loss, because obviously a game set on the moon, I have a lot of interest in that kind of a thing, and the fact that it was this sort of atmospheric first-person shooter for Nintendo DS, I was, you know, really impressed by the boldness of trying to do that. They also made the Dementium games, which were similar in some ways, more of a horror theme. But this is really far from a first-person shooter. I mean, Mutant Muds is looks kind of like an NES game. It's a 2D platformer, very, very simple mechanics, and it has these sort of 8-bit retro-style graphics and music, and the music's really good, too. I bet you guys would enjoy it. And the gameplay is very tight. It has a really nice feel to it. It really feels like they nailed the controls and the physics and the level design, and what surprised me is that the game is so difficult. I mean, Mutant Muds is no joke. It is a challenging 2D platformer, and I'm totally cool with that. You know, I enjoy that kind of stuff. I really like my VVV, VVV, and stuff like that. Although, the game that it reminds me the most of is Wario Land for Virtual Boy, because another game where the mechanics themselves are actually very simple. About, you know, Wario basically jumps and he charges, and he doesn't do a whole lot more in that game, but the cool thing is that you're moving forward in the layers of the screen or backward in the layers of the screen. So your character gets smaller or gets really big. And with the 3D effect on, you kind of get that feel that the layers are still behind or in front of him when he does this. If you turn it off, it just looks like he gets really small. Kind of like in Super Paper Mario, I think, did this, where you could kind of sometimes go into the background.
A Thousand Year Door did it. I remember that.
Oh, okay. Was it that one? So it's definitely been done before, but I think with the 3D effect, just like on Virtual Boy, it really enhances that feeling. And the interesting thing about Mutant Muds is that when you're way back in the background, the things in the foreground can obscure what's going on. So you kind of have to be a little more cautious maybe, or maybe it kind of drives you to look for secret things that might be hidden by obstructions in the foreground. So that's kind of neat. And then when you're in the very front layer, you're so close to the screen. I mean, you're so big that you have almost no warning of what's coming on. So you tend to want to move very cautiously because there's just not enough real estate on the screen to show you very far in front. So you tend to, you're making these shorter jumps and you're watching for enemies because you're not going to have much time to kill them before they get to you. It's a neat idea. I mean, I think it's ultimately a pretty small game, and that's probably for the best because the mechanics are very simple for sure. I mean, you basically jump and you shoot and you can hover. It's a very simple hover mechanic that just refills when you touch the ground again. And your character doesn't feel all that mobile for whatever reason. Even with the hover ability, it feels like your character is just a little bit stilted in the way he moves, but the levels are definitely designed around that. And, it's pretty impressive stuff. I'd like to see more from these guys for sure. I'm kind of glad that they went out on a limb and made this very old school kind of game, considering their kind of reputation for doing really crazy, bold technical things on DS and maybe trying to stretch the platform to do things it wasn't designed for.
I think Jules Waltham, who runs Renegade, his background, I think, was like working on Turok 2 for the N64 and all. It was a real strong first person background to it. So it's no surprise that's what they were doing on DS from that point of view. But to then go to this complete retro side-scroller is very much kind of a deviation from their typical thing, but it sounds like they've nailed it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's really good, and we just got word that there's going to be a demo on the eShop for Mutant Muds, which I think will be, at least in the West, it will be the first eShop game with a demo. You know, this is the kind of game, because it is very difficult and is very retro, it may not be for everybody, and it certainly is for me, and I think you guys would probably all enjoy it too. But, you know, some people aren't going to get as much out of it. So I think, you know, a demo will be a really good idea. What I can say is I think Mutant Muds is a lot meatier than Mighty Switch Force, which is in some ways a similar kind of game. You could probably say the production values are lower just in terms of, you know, the animation and the extremely detailed artwork and everything is not here. This is a, you know, like I said, it looks kind of like an NES game, but with three layers of depth. But to me, this is more fun to play, and I'm not finished with it, but I've already enjoyed it quite a bit more than I did Mighty Switch Force. So I think it's a better game, and I know a lot of people enjoyed that one. So if you do like Mighty Switch Force, I think you should definitely check this out. And I do love that eShop is sort of becoming a home for some really good games on it. Another one I played this past week is Zen Pinball 3D, which I just had heard so many things about from people on our staff, you know, and it's a game that, like, I don't know that outside of our, you know, close-knit Nintendo community who we all talk to each other, I don't know that many people on the outside of that are really playing this game or talking about it, but it is really good, actually. I mean, to me, a pinball game is exactly the kind of thing that should cost $8 and be downloadable. You know, I mean, I'm not going to go out and buy a disc of pinball games. You know, I don't like pinball that much, but I do like pinball. And Zen Pinball 3D seems to be a really great package. It's got four tables, which I think is a totally decent amount for the price. A couple of them seem better than the other ones, but the ones that are really good, and they have a lot of cool features. And they do some things with the fact that it's a video game that you couldn't do on a real pinball table, even if you could find one anymore. Sometimes when you activate a certain feature and it holds your ball, the camera will zoom in and you'll see some piece of the board moving around and stuff like that. It doesn't interfere with the gameplay, but it kind of makes it feel like this is a board that is somewhat realistic, but in other ways, it's almost just one step beyond what you could do with a real physical pinball table. It's not crazy lasers and, you know, shit like that. They're not aliens walking around on it. It's not Metroid Pinball, which is a really cool game, but this is more realistic than that, but it's also not Pinbot.
So they're using fantasy tables. It's not like the ones that you can get on XBLA or PSN where they're actual tables that they're recreating, right?
I think these are all original tables.
Okay, cool.
I think so, yeah.
I'll have to check that out. I love pinball games. Like, you mentioned one of them, Metroid Pinball, was awesome.
It is really
good.
Yeah,
it's a great game.
And Pokemon Pinball, I'm all over.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that, again, with the collecting aspect of it, that's a game that you really couldn't do on a physical board. I mean, that only makes sense in a video game where you can play it over and over and the game is slightly different every time you play it. That's really fun. But yeah, I do really like video pinball, and this one with the online leaderboards where you can actually compare versus your friends is nice, and it really is set up a lot like Geometry Wars. You get these notices while you're playing that you've just passed so-and-so's score. Keep going. Now you're number 13 on the board, you know, and it really it's slightly distracting, but it also really motivates you to keep going and try to keep your, you know, you've got this one game that seems to be going really, really well and to try to keep that going. So the other thing about it is just that the presentation is nice. There's like 7 or 8 different camera views that you can do, and pretty much all of them make great use of the 3D effect, especially when it zooms in to show you certain features. But just during gameplay, you really do get a nice sense that the board is this kind of three-dimensional thing, and sometimes the ball is closer to you and sometimes it's farther away. And the 3D effect is a lot stronger and more pronounced and more interesting to look at than I would have thought from a pinball game. That's really nice as well. And the surprising thing is just how well it plays, because you think about it, the 3D screen is wide, right? And you're trying to squeeze this vertically oriented pinball table on a wide screen. So they're really kind of cramming it into a very small amount of space on the screen. And yet, especially, you know, once you find a camera angle that you really like, you can kind of stick with that. But it felt a little strange and cramped at first, but as I played it for a couple of minutes, I found that I got used to it really quickly. I mean, maybe it's just that the physics are really on the spot and the ball just does what you feel like it should do. And once you have that feeling, you can kind of mentally adjust your depth perception and your timing and your expectations of where the ball is going to go when it hits certain features. And that all fell into place really quickly, and it worked a lot better than I thought it would. So I would recommend this one for sure. And I think these guys are going to be doing more pinball on 3DS, because I think this has been a pretty big success just based primarily on word of mouth.
Yeah, they're doing Marvel Table, so because yeah, they've already done that on XBLA and PSN, but they're doing it as a separate game in this case. I think it's going to be another package of 4, but in this case, Marvel themed tables for the same price, presumably.
I'm down for that.
No, it's going to be separate, though. It's not going to be...
But it's 2 apps, but it's still all on your system all the time. I mean, it's not like you have to go up and find the other game card and put that in and switch them out and all that shit, you know. It's really not that big of a deal. It'd be really cool if they could put links into the Marvel one that would let you boot directly into the other app if you have it. You know, so you actually don't have to go back out to the 3DS menu and load it up. If they could, I don't know if they can actually get away with that or not.
You mean like DLC? Ooh, that'd be an idea. Sorry.
It's coming.
Look, the whole game is DLC. So
right.
It's DLC for your system. It's one of those apps that... You know, for me, it's not something I'm going to download and, like, sit down for a whole week and just play to death until I'm sick of it. It's one of those things I'll come back to because it's pinball and it is very quick to play and it's always there. It will always be on my 3DS forever now.
Especially since they do that high score thing, which I think I love it when games do that. Like, SSX is doing that right now. MotorStorm RC on Vita is doing that. A lot of games have done it, you know, for a long time. But I think it's awesome. And it's really dangerous because you're like, oh, shit, somebody just beat my time or beat my score. And you immediately get pulled back. And that's why it would be great if both games were to get, you know, if it was just DLC and all included in one package, because then across whatever 8 tables, then you'd constantly be getting updates on your friends beating your score or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Zen Pinball 3D also does this weird thing where it gives you a team score, which is like whatever score you have on this particular pinball table, it combines that with those of all your friends. And because I have 75 or 80 friends on 3DS, and a large percentage of them have this game, my team score is ridiculous. Now, I don't know what that earns me. I don't really know if that has any effect on the game, but it's funny because I'm playing the board and I get 200,000 points or something, and then it says my team score is 25 million.
If you get 30 million, you get to Neptune.
Yeah. It looks impressive anyway. Yeah, maybe it's a Nobi Nobi thing. I don't know. So... Speaking of Sony games, the last thing I wanted to talk about this week, and I'm excited to discuss this with you, Billy, and I'm scared that I'm going to say too much because I don't want to...
That can be dealt with.
Yeah, well, I don't want to spoil this experience for anybody who might be listening. It's the game Journey. It just came out on PSN this week. Well, it came out for PS Plus members last week. You still had to buy it. You just were able to buy it a week earlier than everybody else. I'm not crazy about that idea as a non-subscriber.
As a subscriber, I was all about it.
Yeah, sure. You barely remember the game now. You played it so long ago.
Well, it's true. And it's not very long either. So.
No, it's, I mean, I played the entire game in one session for 2 hours.
Well, it's easy to do that.
I actually think that's the best way to play it, because this is from the same people who made Flower, and I love Flower. I've talked about it on the show a lot. It's a unique game. It's a special game, and I don't want every game to be like Flower. I don't want every game to be like Journey, but I want developers to play these games because I think it will be inspiring for them. I think that it will embolden them to do things that they wouldn't have tried to do otherwise, you know, and not to make the same thing, but to incorporate certain ideas, or just to get a feeling of freedom, of liberation, because these games are just so enchanting. And Journey, I was absolutely enraptured by it. I mean, I got up and I had that kind of feeling of when you walk out of the movie theater and you feel like you've been on another planet for 2 hours, you know, and all of a sudden you walk back into the sunlight, you're like, you know, and you just like have a hard time assimilating back into the real world. That's how I felt from playing Journey. It is a really, really magical experience. It is essentially a 3D platformer with no text, no story. Well, there is a story, but it's told all visually and through sound and through experiencing it yourself. There are no cutscenes, though, not really. It's absolutely gorgeous. Mostly takes place in the desert, and the sand physics and just the way that the sun and the moon play on the desert, and the shadows and the way things are framed, the way the camera swings around and shows you the landscapes. Just really incredible. I think it kind of puts Uncharted 3 to shame in the famous desert scenes from Uncharted 3. I don't think they'll hold a candle to anything in Journey. I think this game's far more beautiful. The music is absolutely astoundingly good.
Yeah.
And it's really fun to play. The controls feel nice, and the gameplay is basically exploring. You have a feeling that you're sort of being guided, right, through this world, but you know, you're not racing through it. You can kind of take it at your own pace for the most part. You can kind of go off and find a few little secret things on the sides here. And it's really just about moving forward on this path, on this journey of your character. And you don't know anything about it when you start out. There's no prelude. There's no introduction.
No, it says press start and you start your journey.
And you're in the desert and you don't know why you're there. You don't know what you're doing. You don't know where you're going or what you're supposed to be doing. And these things are slowly revealed to you over time in the course of playing the game. And that's why I don't want to say what happens or what the game is ultimately about, because getting to see that stuff for yourself is a huge part of why you would want to play this game.
Now, did you, because there is co-op in the game,
yeah,
but you can't voice chat or pick who you're playing with.
Can you turn it off? I mean, I wouldn't think so, because there's no menu.
I don't think so.
There's no menu in the game. You can't even pause, really.
No, because it's always going. And actually, if you put the controller down for a while, it just kind of goes into like this screensaver loop. And then you pick up a controller and then your journey continues. I mean, I thought it was cool, you know, for $15, it's kind of like paying for an expensive movie when you live in Los Angeles, and that's how much a movie costs, and it lasts about the same amount.
Yeah.
You know, it's definitely a one sitting game. Like, I almost put it down and then I was like, I'll just keep dicking around with it. And next thing I know, it's over. And I was like, really? That's it?
I tell you what, Billy, if I had paid $15 to go into a theater and it was just a video of someone playing this game from start to finish, I would have been pretty pleased with my expenditure.
Yeah, and to be honest, like, I have a feeling I'm going to play through it again.
Yeah.
Like, I ended up playing, I don't know if this is a spoiler or not, so you can cut this out if you want to later, but you don't know who you're playing with. Like, you can't, like, if I wanted to play with Johnny, like, it would be out of complete coincidence.
The co-op is really, really innovative, and I love it. And this is a feature I do hope other games will do. I mean, it definitely wouldn't work for every game, but it's so organic. There's no menus. There's no pings. There's no fucking lobbies. You know, there's no people cursing you and calling you racial epithets.
Yeah.
It is just, look, there's another person. I don't know anything about this person. They know as much about this game as I do, which is very little. And we're just going to experience it together. We can barely communicate. We interact a little bit. The game is definitely more enjoyable to play with another person, because you have this jump ability that's limited, but when you're next to another person, it recharges. So it lets you play the game in a little bit more of a free-flowing, kind of joyous way when you have another person there. And you get to see what they do. You get to see them try things, and they're not sure if it's going to work or not. But then you see it, and you say, oh, okay. And for me, it was really cool because, like, we were finding secrets, and then we would kind of – there's a mechanic that you can kind of sing or pray or shout or something like that. And it activates certain elements in the environment. But you can also use it to just kind of, you know, ping the other person, say, hey, come over here, or I need help, or there's something going on. And we found kind of some of the people I played it with, we found ways to express, hey, I found a secret. You should come over here and get it before we move on, or else you're going to miss it. So we're exploring together, and you know, ultimately, it is nice to have that companion with you, and that was surprising to me, to play a video game with a stranger online, and feel like we developed this sort of companionship, and not quite friendship, but we at least experienced something together.
See, I think that's cool.
I love the anonymity of it. I really do.
I agree, but I also wish there was an option, like, either if you experience that from the outset in your first playthrough, because it's so freaking short, like, I know I want to go back and play through it again. It's like seeing a movie again, you know, it's like, I just want to experience that again. But after playing through it once, it would be nice if you had the option to not get into a lobby, but play with a friend through it.
But then would you be chatting with them? I think.
Yeah, I would like that.
Even if they don't put voice chat in the game, I think if you can matchmake with a friend, you could be on Skype or be on your phones and talking through the game. I don't think they want that. I think they want you to experience the game in a kind of a pure way, you know, and knowing the other person. For one thing, that other person's probably not going to play that much differently than a random stranger, because the game is pretty simple. You know, the things that you can do are fairly simple, but also I think they, you know, it would just disturb the experience so much if you were constantly commenting on it as you go through it with somebody else and, you know, trying to formulate strategies and stuff like that. You don't need to do that stuff, and I just don't think they want you to.
Well, the point still stands, though, if we're talking about replays. I mean, it's like, you know, you get it, if you rewatch films, sometimes you'll rewatch it with a friend and it'll turn into like a pseudo director's commentary, or you might just start shooting the shit about whatever, but it might make it more apt to play through it again if you don't have to be sort of glued to it the same way as you were the first time. So that's why it would make sense if it were like an unlock thing. It's certainly equally as reasonable to me as locking your ability to attach pictures and swap notes.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the anonymity in the first time you played through it. I didn't know the four people that I played through it with, and I thought it was pretty cool. And I agree, it's awesome, because nobody can be a dick. I mean, I'm sure you could figure out a way, but like...
I don't think you could, really.
Because even if you stop, I think that it seamlessly will...
It'll just pull someone else in.
Right, and I think that's awesome. So I like that, but I do wish there was that option. But other than that, it should be experienced. Like, I think... regardless of, you know, the cost for, you know, how much of a game you get, I think it's well worth experiencing. It's really unique, and I love their stuff. I really like Flow. I love Flower. This kind of has, at points, certain flowery type elements, and I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, to me, it feels like a natural evolution from Flower. It feels like the more advanced step. All the elements are in Flower, really, but they're doing more with it here. It's a magical experience, and I think you should just go ahead and get used to the idea of Journey being discussed as a game of the year, because that's not going to go away. Not everybody will love it as much as I did, but it's going to get talked about a lot. But in terms of doing something fresh in the 3D platforming space, thank God somebody is actually interested in that, because I've talked about it recently, but that genre has not held up very well over the years, and it's not being explored very well, especially outside of Nintendo. And to me, this was not a game that Nintendo would ever make, but I'm so glad that other people are really trying to continue doing things in this space and look at the potential that it has. Okay, well, that's Journey. If you have a PS3, I think you should play it. I'm totally in love with it, obviously. So, okay, that's going to wrap up new business. So now we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about some other interesting things in the world of gaming.
And now for something completely different.
Sometimes the law is all that keeps the tyranny of crime from ruling over us. Sometimes it takes a mouse to beat a cat. the producers of Pac-Man 30th Anniversary Special Edition video comes Mappy, the audio adventure.
Attention Patrol 208, please proceed to 17 Summit. Report of a 459A in progress.
17 Summit? That's right around the corner. I should hurry. There's definitely signs of breaking and entering here. Wait, what's that sound? Sounds like... Oh. Sounds like cats. Meowkies. Why does it have to be the Meowkies? I don't even know why I keep locking them up. The DA just lets them out again. It's like everyone turns a blind eye to their thievery. Attention! This is the police! Come out with your paws up!
Of course, what he doesn't know, what he couldn't possibly know, is the truth behind the Meowkies.
What do you mean they're robots? I've arrested them tons of times. They're just regular cats. Well, cat burglars. I don't understand. You're saying that they're actually robots from beneath the surface of the world?
Do you realize that makes no sense, right?
Imprisoned for 30 years, the Meowkies escaped. And it's up to one officer, Mappy the Mouse, to put them back.
Stop or I'll shoot! I swear! Oh god, they're still coming. God, what do I do?
Can Mappy recover the stolen radio, television, computer, safe, and even the Mona Lisa from the vile Meowkies? And can he confront their cybernetic ghost cat robot boss, escape from the center of the Earth and created as part of an experiment, Meowmco, and put him away for good? To find out, you'll have to keep listening to Mappy, the audio adventure, right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with a second review on Mario Party 9 for Wii by Pedro Hernandez, who says, "We like to party with Mario and friends," and I'll leave you to discern how Wii was spelled when it was originally on the website.
Yeah, but Neil thinks that's like the best Mario Party in years and years and years.
And we also have a review for the DS, Shin Megami Tensei Devil Survivor 2 by Nate Andrews, who says it's a solid, if similar, follow-up to the DS game that's already been ported to the 3DS.
So wait 6 months and then pay $20 more for the 3DS version of this.
All right, and we also have Impressions of Fractured Soul Deep Void for 3DS by Aaron Kaluska. He says it's perennially troubled but innovative platformer. It sports a drastically new skin.
That game sounds really cool, actually. Might be coming to eShop.
And we also have impressions for the eShop game Colors 3D by Carmine Kai Red. Colors 3D ups the ante on 3D painting with cooperative multiplayer. Interesting.
So we can draw dicks together.
I'm not even touching that one, Johnny.
Yeah, I hope you're not, John. I hope so.
Well, I'm more than done after that comment.
Nate Andrews provides us a preview of the 3DS title Planet Crashers 3D, which is Renegade's Kid's latest simple and colorful RPG. We also have a feature, the Japan eShop Roundup by Danny Bivens. This week, it's Game Gear Go-Go, baby.
And the Game Gear games are out in the West as well now, so...
Yeah, now it's Game Gear everywhere.
I'm looking forward to not playing any of those.
It's such a strong lineup. Yeah. I don't know what you're talking about.
The quality of the emulation presentation does leave you to wonder if they are trying to make up for something.
All right, so we've got a feature this week called Fave 5. It's Neil's Fave 5 Pictures of Sakurai's Cat. Yes, Masahiro Sakurai, famous for posting pictures of his adorable kitty on Twitter. Neil has collected the 5 best.
And they are adorable, too.
They are really pictures. Cute, actually. It's a dumb feature that you should probably click on. And we have another feature called NWR Game Club Number 1. It's a boy and his blob. So Neil tells us to feed your little blob some jelly beans with us. And the idea behind this is that the entire website is going to play A Boy and His Blob for Wii, and they're going to be talking about it on Connectivity. So you can look forward to that. I think they're going to try to do one per month. It's similar to Retroactive, but more expansive beyond this particular podcast. And A Boy and His Blob is definitely a worthy game, deserves to be played. So I hope you'll check that out and participate. And that is just a sampling of all the great original content on the site. In addition to the original stuff, we've always got your news, screenshots, videos. We have lots of crazy stuff going on the website all the time. So be sure to head over to NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to the show, everyone. We are now joined by Mr. James Jones.
Ohio.
And we've still got BB Action here with us. I'm making it stick.
I don't know, man.
So this is kind of going to be a little bit of a grab bag. There's a couple interesting topics I wanted to bring up, especially since we had Billy here, and we're recharging our mail reserves, and we're working on other segment and feature ideas and stuff like that. But it's been an interesting day in the gaming media, and we're going to talk about some of the crazy stuff that's gone down in a little bit. But first, Billy, I wanted to take this opportunity to talk to you about what you're doing now, because after EGM, you were doing some freelance stuff for a while, and, you know, we read your stuff in various magazines and websites and stuff like that. But it feels like you've been more quiet lately, and I guess that's related to your new career. So can you tell us a little bit about what a game consultant does?
Yeah, I've been quiet lately because I've been moving. You guys know, or anybody that's moved, it sucks. So that's one reason why I've been quiet. But, I mean, I tend to be pretty vocal about games on Twitter. But as far as, like, consulting, I've been doing that on the side for a while. I did it actually before I moved to G4, and you might hear rumblings of people talking about mock reviews and things like that. And I am doing that, but I'm doing things a little bit more extended from that. But what a mock review is, sometimes, you know, especially if you're seasoned in the press or in the industry for a long time, you might get an opportunity to do a mock review, and a publisher will contact you and send you code before they, generally it's before the press will get it for review or even preview to get your opinion on it. And sometimes you'll actually review the game, and you'll review it, and that stuff will actually never be public. Like, you're doing it for the publisher. They want to get your opinion. It helps depending on where in the process development the game is. Sometimes you could point out bugs or things that might need to get fixed or could get fixed or changed before the retail game comes out.
So basically what you did for Metal Gear Solid 4 in Japan.
I'm
tugging at you a little bit. I mean, that was a controversial event because Konami invited a lot of press, including you, to come play the game, but they were kind of asking for your feedback. You know, it was kind of early enough that they could make a few last minute changes to it before the game was complete. And they paid for everybody to fly out there, and they gave you hotel rooms and everything. And a lot of people were kind of like, is this ethical? You know, I mean, you know, obviously what you're doing now is ethical. It was weird when people were actually, like, you know, professional journalists, and they were.
Right. And that situation was a lot different because, A, we could write a preview on it. It was not a review event that, you know, and a lot of, you know, publishers, especially for AAA big titles like Call of Duty, do them. I think Gears did it. They'll have review events where they fly people to some undisclosed location, and then you get to play through the game and, you know, maybe do multiplayer and all that sort of stuff and get the stuff in a quiet area. You know, I'd say the Metal Gear thing was kind of a focus group for them, I think. And yeah. I find it fascinating. I mean, I've been reviewing games for a long time, and I like what I'm doing now because I'm hoping that I might be able to have an effect on the game. And what I'm doing now is very challenging because not every project is, like, super rad, you know? So sometimes I'll get a game where it might just be not very good, or sometimes I get a really good game. And, you know, it's interesting trying to, I hope that I can actually have an impact on the game and make a game better, you know, and that's something I've never had the opportunity as press to do before. So, you know, and obviously it depends on where the game is in its development cycle. Sometimes it might be too late, but maybe out of the 30 things that I didn't like about the game, they could fix 3 or 4, and maybe that'll help them get a better score, you know, or maybe that'll make that experience better for the consumer.
Okay, so for the mock review thing, I mean, I think this is really interesting because, especially if it really is a review, if the game is pretty much finished and they just haven't sent out review code to the press yet, it seems like the publisher then is probably trying to steal themselves. Like, they're going to use whatever you give them as part of the marketing plan or part of the PR plan. They're going to sort of figure out how do they sell this to people. So at that point, you're not necessarily influencing the game itself. You're influencing the game's perception among the people that the publisher's then going to go send it to, right?
Maybe, or, you know, say the game, hypothetically, say the publisher thinks this game's going to perform really well, and I think it's not, or give it a bad review, mm-hmm. you know, or point out this is where this game's failing, or it could be completely different, where I'm surprising them and saying, actually, this game's really good. You know, it just gives them a good idea of what to expect from the press at large. I mean, everybody's opinions are different. I mean, there's, for as many nines or tens as some game's going to get, I mean, not everybody's going to love a game.
Right.
There's going to be that smaller percentage. But as I said, you know, my goal is in my new career path, or at least what I'm hoping it to be, is to have an influence on games and to make games better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I imagine that would be the concern, is that, you know, is it so much influencing games and ultimately, you know, helping deliver a better experience for consumers, as you mentioned earlier, or is it actually drawing up a battle plan for the publisher's spin machine? You know, one of those sounds rather rewarding, the other one sounds quite soul-crushing, and I imagine it's not necessarily that easy to know how your feedback is going to be used.
But Greg, in the defense of the latter, I mean, I just want to say, you say a spin machine, but all of us have played games that we wished the publisher understood how to sell to people better. You know, when you play a game that you really want to champion because it feels like it's being underrated and underexposed, and you feel like, man, that these guys did not know what they had on their hands. They didn't know how good of a product this is, and they've made no effort to tell anyone about
all
it,
the
or
time.
They've told people about it in completely the wrong way. And I just want to defend the possibility of actually being able to inform a publisher and say, you know what, you should really push this because it's fucking good.
Yeah, there's a good side to that, but then there's the dark side, you know, which would be...
with the Sith Lords?
Well, you know, the idea, basically, look, people are going to complain about this, so be ready for it with whatever dark arts they employ. Like, plants on forums, you know, whatever kind of shit they do. We know they do it. You know they do it. And you're basically giving them the heads up.
I don't know why that's dark side. That's focus testing. I mean, companies do this all the time. All of them do this.
You'd be crazy not to.
It's not the knowledge you generate that's evil. It's what they can do with it.
Yeah, like I said, you know, the people planting reviews on Metacritic and all that kind of stuff, you know, they could actually take what's a bad part of the game and then have these assertions out there that, oh, no, that's not a big deal, that's fine, and you know, specifically to counter it, to avoid that becoming kind of salient and dominant in the discourse about the game online. And you know, these are, you know, I'm sure they do this sort of thing.
Oh, no, Catherine's perfectly normal. Don't worry about that part.
Well, no, but I mean, it's exactly what Lindy said. They'd be stupid not to do something like this, whether it's using a consultant or having focus testing or anything like that. You're investing millions of dollars to launch a game. You know, mm-hmm. Are you just going to launch it in the ether and just hope it fucking does well?
Nintendo does, yes.
Some things.
Now, Billy, is this mostly stuff, is this like the kind of work you do from home, or do you spend a lot of time going out and visiting studios and like seeing it from the inside?
Right now, it's all been from home. And which has actually worked really well with my schedule now that I've been moving. I just had a lot of shit, you know, just getting settled here. But I think eventually, and I've been asked to actually go direct to the developer and as well too. So
that would be really cool.
I haven't done that yet, but that's stuff that I'd like to do.
Yeah. I mean, to me, if you really want to influence the game's development, that would be ideal. If they are willing to give you that kind of access, and it seems like they would be because, you know, you have these confidentiality agreements and they're implicitly trusting you to be honest. In another sense, it might be more difficult to be critical of the game and to be honest about it and forthright when you're facing the guy who worked on it, you know, and telling him, you really should straighten this shit out before you send it up the chain. Yeah. That might be tougher, but just the level of access that you're going to have and the feedback, the direct real-time feedback with the developers. I mean, that, to me, even going to press events, that was exciting. And usually by that point, it's way too late to do anything when I got to see games. But it was still exciting to actually talk talk about the games, and you really do feel like you understand them better when you can interact with the developers in that way. And I guess my final question about this, before we move on to all the giant bomb and one-up stuff, is you've been a freelance journalist before. I've done a very little bit of it for you, actually. You know, Neil's done it even while he was director of the website. He's, you know, run stuff through GamePro and 1UP and stuff like that. And I know a lot of freelance writers, and that's a pretty tough gig, because what people don't realize is the difficult part of being a freelance writer is not the writing, it's getting the jobs, because you don't have any kind of steady commitment from anybody. So like putting together rent on a freelance salary, because there is no salary. Like, you might have really good months, you might have really bad months, and you know, I think you spend a lot more time talking to people about what you could write for them and then hammering out the details and then arguing about, oh, you didn't write what they wanted, etc. All that, to me, is a lot more effort and more time-consuming than actually just writing the stuff, which is what you would think your actual job is. Is consulting like that for you, or do you have some kind of – do you have someone giving you assignments so you don't have to
– Yeah, I'm working with a company.
Okay.
And freelancing is tough. And actually, the landscape, especially in the last 5 or 6 years, I mean, the landscape has changed a lot. And freelancing actually used to pay a lot more, you know, and the publishers and websites and magazines used to care a lot more about the quality of work, you know. And I'm being very vague in what I'm saying now.
Hey,
but
I don't have to be. I wrote an article for EGM when you were the editor in chief there, and it was the ESRB article I'd had brewing in my head for like 8 years, some version of that. I put 20 hours into that project. I interviewed people, dozens of emails back and forth. It took weeks just to do the writing and the editing and to get it all put together. I only made a couple hundred bucks off of it. I didn't do it for the money. I did it because I wanted to have an article printed in EGM, which I grew up reading as a kid. But also, you know, I wasn't depending on that for income, thank God. But it doesn't pay that well. It really doesn't. And I feel bad for people who are actually trying to like support themselves on that kind of thing, because it's really tough. I mean, I think the more famous you are, and somebody who's as well known as you, Billy, would have somewhat of an easier time just making the connections and maybe getting repeat business with different media outlets. But like on a per article basis, the amount you get paid is pretty shitty compared to how much effort you put into it. And that's not even to speak of all the assignments that you worked on that never did get printed, so you didn't get paid for them. A lot is like half-baked ideas that are really good, but you can't sell them because nobody wants, you know, sometimes you write the article and you say, hey, I've got this completely written article, it's ready to go, why don't you publish it and pay me for it? And nobody wants it, so you did all that work and got nothing out of it. I mean, that's tough.
Yeah, and plus, especially with, you know, the way the economy's been and everything like that, a lot of places before they've laid off people is they've just killed their freelance budget. So there's just a lot less work around. And, you know, there's been so many layoffs and so many magazines closing and websites closing or shifting or whatever. The marketplace and the freelance pool has definitely gotten bigger.
Yeah, more competition.
And some people just really aren't good at working at home. I've worked at home long enough that it doesn't really faze me. So, you know, I like it both ways.
All right. That was interesting. Thanks for talking about that stuff with us. Because I remember when InGuy left Newsweek to go do his consulting business. And he sort of vaguely described it in a top level, but then I never heard anything else about it ever again, you know, and I think he still does that, some of that stuff.
Yeah, he does. His company Hit Detection. And, well, because you're not allowed to talk about it.
Right. I mean, that's tough. I mean, certainly in the specifics, but just in the process, I think it is fascinating. I think it's an aspect of the gaming industry that a lot of people don't even know exists, much less understand how it's done. And it, you know, there's probably very few people who actually do it. Because you do have to have a lot of cachet with these publishing companies, you know, in order for them to want to pay you to do this. They have to really value your opinion. I mean, to me, it's the highest compliment, you know, coming from years of, you know, getting nasty phone calls from PR people who complain about, you know, your reviews, and they say you didn't give the game a fair chance, or they, you know, or whatever. The idea of a publisher actually paying you to write a review, and to be honest, not to write it in a certain way, it's not payola, it's to write it and to be honest and tell them exactly what you think, that they really value your opinion and your ability to be eloquent and descriptive and to say something meaningful about the game that you played. That's a very high compliment, and it's a shame that your work is more or less hidden from the rest of the world. I would love to read some of the stuff you're writing for these guys, and hopefully, like you said, it does go to make the games better or to help people find out about games that they might not have otherwise found out about.
Thanks. I mean, I've got other things going on. I have been talking to people about full-time work. There's a few things that are cooking right now that I'm not able to talk about yet, but yeah, it's just kind of the way things happened. Like, I was planning on continuing to freelance for a couple of places. I was talking to a couple of outlets and stuff, but the consulting stuff has been so heavy that I've just kind of stuck with it and really, really enjoying it.
Yes, and you heard it here first. Billy Berghammer is being bought out by GameSpot.
No. I wouldn't mind working with those guys. That was a crazy announcement today. Waking up and seeing, you know, a couple people getting, unfortunately, canned at 1UP, which is very sad, and then seeing GameSpot picking up Giant Bomb. That's just too crazy.
That's such a weird situation, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, it kind of seems like that whole site went full circle on us, doesn't it?
Yeah, I found out about it on Twitter. I was in some training classes today for work, and it was one of those things where you check Twitter and the conversation has already moved on from what the actual news is to people commenting on it. So you kind of have to infer, wait, what just happened? And then you kind of go back and try to find the articles where things are being announced, except it was all done in videos that I couldn't watch on my phone while I was at this training session. And so I'm like trying to piece together the facts of what the hell's going on. And it was all still kind of in flux and there were a lot of questions. But, you know, let's talk about the bad news first so we can all, you know, end on a high note. The bad news is, for 1UP, they laid off three people today and plus another one from IGN who owns 1UP. They bought 1UP about a year ago, it seems like, and then not too long after that, Jeremy Parrish was named the editor-in-chief of 1UP, which is, to me, kind of crazy because Jeremy's been there for a long time, but always seemed like the stuff that he was interested in and the kinds of content that he produced for them were fairly esoteric. You know, I mean, he ran Retronauts, which did the blog and the podcast, and he has really unusual tastes in gaming, and he was a great writer. You know, he's been around a long time, but I was always like, really? It was strange to me, the idea of Parrish running that website, but I didn't realize just how small it had become. I mean, 1UP, you know, anytime you do a merge like that, a lot of times you start shedding people because now their roles are redundant with people who are already in the organization or whatever. That's part of why they do mergers.
Yeah, but Jeremy also ran has a side project magazine. You know, yeah. He does a lot. Jeremy's one smart motherfucker.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, he's amazing. I think it was a great move for 1UP and definitely brought in a lot of fresh air and a lot of different perspective. But they did lose two main people today. I don't, you know, Ryan as well, but like Matt and Scooter, like that's, that just makes me throw up a little bit. Like they were kind of two of the main guys that were still there. They were are definite workhorses. I'm very afraid of the future of what's going to happen there.
Yeah. And so is Matt Leone and Terry Nguyen, Scooter. Are sort of institutions. Matt had been at 1UP continuously for like a really long time. I think Scooter had been at GameSpot or something else a few years ago, but then they brought him back. He had been there for the past few years. And then the third person laid off today is Ryan Winterhalter, who actually used to write for us. And you can go to our site and search his name and you'll find some of the articles he wrote. He's a really cool guy. And, you know, one of a lot of examples of people who volunteered at PGC and NWR and went on to become professionals. And so I didn't know him well, but, you know, that was definitely sad to see. And hopefully he's going to turn out okay. But it is a rough business. You know, there's a lot of turnover in games media, and it's not a very lucrative industry. You know, I mean, they mostly live on ad dollars, which kind of have these swells and dips over time.
Yeah, but this year has been, I mean, every year is generally crazy. I usually say that, you know, I've been part of it where I've hired a pile of people in a crazy team and I've done it multiple times, or I've seen other places like this year, Vox, you know, the whole Verge thing where they poached a good chunk of what was Joystick. They got Crescente from Kotaku. I mean, they built just a crazy powerhouse team. Those guys are working with Area 5. I mean, that's just do a giant leap into the fold. And then you had, you know, IGN picking up 1UP like that. Who the fuck ever thought that that would happen?
Yeah,
and now
that was weird.
Today, the whole full circle of Giant Bomb, which is comprised mainly of people that left GameSpot, are now returning to GameSpot.
I think the editorial staff was entirely ex-GameSpot people.
I think there was one or two people who they picked up later.
Well, yeah, Klepek worked for me.
But yeah, the founding staff was that group that splintered off after stuff.
Well, and that stuff was discussed today. So the story with Giant Bomb is that, yeah, they were primarily ex-GameSpot people. They all left GameSpot. Some of them were fired. Some of them quit in protest. They formed this new website, made it very successful over the past 4 years. And then today we found out that they have now been purchased by CBS Interactive, which owns GameSpot. So now, and which is now run by totally different people, including John Davison, the former, you know, One Up Yours guy, who's like one of my heroes, especially in podcasts. And now with another one of my heroes, Jeff Gerstmann. So they're working together.
Totally different reasons.
But now they're on the same team. And it's really strange, you know, because Giant Bomb, it seemed like the essence of that was a big fuck you to GameSpot.
It was like a big protest.
It's like, we're going to do things completely the opposite of the way you guys do it. And now they're owned by the same company. They're essentially working together. They're going to be sharing offices. They're going to have a couple people swapping back and forth. And they've promised, and they've made it extremely clear today that Giant Bomb is going to continue doing things the way that they do them. And that this is basically more resources for them, but it's not about, you know, finding redundancies. It's not about efficiencies. It's not about trying to change what they do and make them more like GameSpot or to combine the sites or anything like that.
I think it's more telling that members of the Giant Bomb staff are being added to the editorial panel and the advisory panels for the CBS Interactive.
Well, to be honest, I mean, well, two things. One, the thing that you mentioned is the most important thing, and that's resources. I mean, being able to have a very large budget, you know, and allowing to travel and pay for all that. I mean, to build a site is freaking expensive. Trust me. And to pay for editorial stuff is very expensive. And Giant Bomb, they did things. I mean, I don't know what their budget is like.
It always seemed to be on a shoestring.
They had to take donations to go on a trip one time.
Yeah.
But that's great. And people paid for it, you know? And
yeah. We've done that too, by the way. So.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. You know, I think it's great that they're going to have the resources to do that. But the other thing is GameSpot, like, I stopped going there because the people that I liked that were there left. So
right.
Those guys really, they oozed a lot of personality, which is what people love over at Giant Bomb. And now that that's back there, fucking smart move for GameSpot. And I think John is a really smart guy for working that out. And I think it's great. And I'm very happy. You know, I know all the parties involved, and I'm fucking happy for him. Like, that's great. That just makes it stronger, hopefully, in theory. I mean, I see a lot of freak out on the gaff and everywhere else. Great. People freak out. You know, let's just see what happens first.
To me, the only possible downside is that doing things on a shoestring budget was almost part of the charm of Giant Bomb. And sometimes it was probably unpleasant for the guys working there, you know, to put a lot of hardship on them to actually make anything happen with very, very limited resources. But you take that away and like, is it, they say it's still going to be weird and stupid and crazy and funny, but like, is it like a little bit too polished? Is it the second half of Wayne's World? We're in the studio and they've got the music and the announcer and everything. And it just doesn't feel like it used to. I understand some trepidation from the fans that way. And look, I'm a paid member of Giant Bomb. So I'm a fan. I'm a big fan of what they do. I'm not really that concerned about it, to tell you the truth. I think it's more interesting than to me, because I don't really know those guys personally. I've met a couple, but I don't really know them. I'm not really friends with them. It's not necessarily like a good thing or a bad thing. And I don't feel emotional about it. I just think it's weird.
Yeah, I'd say just wait and see. I'm not that concerned. I think they wanted them because they're creative and they do unique, weird, fucked up, crazy stuff, and I don't see them trying to change that.
Right.
But anyway, the internet freaks out whenever there's change, you know.
It's part of life, and like I said, it is a very volatile industry. So
absolutely.
It's never surprising to me that people get hired, people get fired, things merge, new sites come up out of the blue. That's the way it's always been, and I generally just kind of take it in stride. And I'm just glad that, you know, on our site, we've been unusually consistent. It's partly just because of the way that our structure is set up. We're all volunteers. We do this
right.
On our own time. We do it because we like it. We have virtually no outside pressures from anyone. And so we're given a lot of freedom, and I like to think we make good use of it. You know, we don't take it for granted, but Suffice it to say, over the years, we've had offers from outside companies and we turn them down. You know, a lot of people were like, we can turn your site professional. We can start paying all your staff members. We can get you greater exposure. And it's, you know, a lot of times the conversation came back and we said, you know, some of us might want that, but overall, we kind of felt like there was a consensus that that's not really what we ever wanted to get. That's not what we expected, and it's not really what we were going for out of the site.
Yeah, it brings a host of new headaches, too. It's just...
Oh, boy. I had some very scary conversations with people about that stuff, and it, you know, it very quickly got into territory where I was like, you know, you guys are offering a lot of incentives here that I do not want and never wanted, and... I'm glad we never went with it.
More money, more problems, baby.
Yeah. I mean, we're in a totally different, weird situation, and it's part of why we've been around for almost 13 years. Actually, it has been 13 years now. I think by the time you hear this, it pretty much will be the 13th anniversary of the site. So good time to have Billy on here. And we're going to have to wrap up the episode, actually, but you can send your emails about anything going on in the world of gaming. We'll be happy to read them and talk about them on an episode very soon. You can send those to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. That's going to do it for this episode. So thanks, Billy, very much for being here and talking to us about some of this stuff.
Thanks for having me. Anytime, guys.
Yeah, man. We'll look forward to hearing more of you on various podcasts and Twitter. You're at Louie the Cat.
I am at Louie the Cat. And by the way, you missed the birthday. The birthday was March 7th.
Really? Oh, I thought it was like the 21st for some reason.
Nope.
So you're saying the cat is not actually the cat toitering?
No, but our site is literally so old we can't remember our own birthdays anymore.
Yeah. Yep.
It's a good place to be, though. You know, we're very comfortable with it.
Oh, my God. I just had a terrible age realization.
Yeah.
Hey, just realized that one of the guys in our initial E3s that we got in with an underage pass is now getting married and bought a house. So that's how old we are.
Yeah.
I remember when dinosaurs could fly.
Johnny, I did get that reference, and I do remember when dinosaurs could fly.
Thank you. It's good to be appreciated.
Mario 64.
That was awesome. Well played.
All right, guys. That's going to do it for the show. We will see you next week.
I tried figuring it out, like, you know, and I all of a sudden I had all these notes from a bunch of you guys and Obi, and people are attaching pictures, and I couldn't figure out how to attach pictures, and then somebody told me that I needed to send more notes before it would allow me to do that.
Yeah.
Like,
well, that's...
I still have no idea how to do that, by the way.
You just have to keep writing notes.
Well, after I put your friend code in, I look forward to getting 18 or 19 pictures of dicks, and then...
Oh, well, you will now. And they'll just be sent to you,
though. In
3D. It's, this shit is on.
Yep, that's my weekend plan made.
And then you're going to take one picture and say, okay, now it works, and then you'll never use it again.
I'm disturbed by what that picture might be of at this point, to be honest. Some sort of Brett Favre scenario.
Yeah, bad intentions.
We need Mario.
Hey.
You know that's coming, Billy. Hey, Billy, I've got bad intentions. Send.
Yeah, you can delete apps, right?
I'm gonna put that 3D to good use, Billy. Don't worry. Yeah, well, someone else may have a different perspective, or maybe know the genre a bit more than you do.
Like Mystery Dungeon.
This.
Lindemann, is that why it takes you so long to write a fucking review, or what?
he was actually reenacting Spiderwick Chronicles in his home. It's a 21-act
play. It's called cosplay, all right? Shut up.